Welcome back to The Deep Dive. I'm Tommy Marcherson.
And I'm Max Raisin, and it's a pleasure to be here.
Today, we are undertaking a deep dive into an incredibly varied stack of source material.
We're looking at the New Scientist magazine for the week of December 6th, 2025.
And our mission really is to connect fields that, on the surface, seem to have nothing in common. We're talking about the fundamental chaos inside a black hole.
All the way to how the very first living proteins might have reproduced.
Exactly. And then we'll jump to the ethical frontiers of medicine, the emergence of the first hominins, and even the market dynamics of the most advanced AI chips.
Right. The goal is for you, the listener, to walk away with a genuine insight into how all these different scientific threads are, well, challenging our most entrenched assumptions about reality.
What's so fascinating about this collection, I think, is how often the big shifts in thinking come from realizing that complexity doesn't need a single huge miracle.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. It's more about two smaller, kind of messy processes finding a way to collaborate.
And that's a theme that just repeats itself everywhere, from biology to cosmology.
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's unpack that idea of decentralized complexity. And we're starting with the ultimate origin story.
The biggest one there is.
It's a feature titled The Spark That Started Life: Proteins, Prions, and Our Unexpected Origin. So when scientists are tackling abiogenesis, you know, that spontaneous jump from chemistry to biology about 4 billion years ago.
Leading to LUCA, the last universal common ancestor.
Right. What's the fundamental catch-22 that they've been struggling with for so long?
Well, the barrier is the interdependence of all life as we know it. I mean, life by definition needs two things.
Okay.
It needs metabolism, so the ability to process energy and molecules. And it needs reproduction, which is the ability to copy information and, you know, evolve.
And today, those two jobs are split. DNA holds the information, and proteins do all the work, the metabolism.
Exactly. But you need proteins to build and read the DNA, and you need the DNA to give the instructions for making the proteins. It's the ultimate chicken and egg problem.
So which one came first?
That's the billion-dollar question. And for decades, the intellectual favorite was the RNA world hypothesis.
Right, because RNA, which is a sort of molecular cousin to DNA, seemed like it could solve that dilemma on its own.
It did. It looked like the perfect solution because RNA is a molecule of multiple talents. This goes back to pioneering work by Francis Crick in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
He showed that RNA is unique because it can do both jobs. Like DNA, it can encode information in its sequence. But, and this is the crucial part, it can also fold into complex 3D shapes and act as a catalyst, an enzyme.
We call those ribozymes.
Exactly, ribozymes. So in theory, one RNA molecule could hold the instructions and perform the reactions needed to copy itself and run a basic metabolism.
And there have been lab experiments recently, I think in 2023, that actually created self-copying ribozymes, right?
Yes, which shows it's chemically plausible. It looks like the perfect solo act for the prebiotic world.
But the article introduces a pretty major flaw, a big stability issue. If this RNA world was just starting out in some prebiotic soup, it wouldn't last very long.
Not at all. That's its Achilles heel. The complex RNA molecules, the ones that are big enough to act as enzymes, are just notoriously unstable in water. They degrade, they fall apart very quickly.
So whether life started in a shallow pond or a deep sea vent, that RNA would have needed some kind of protection.
It would have needed stabilizers. And in modern life, those stabilizers are proteins. But if this was a pure RNA world, those proteins weren't there yet. It's a huge sticking point.
Okay, so if we swing the pendulum the other way, we get to the protein-first approach. And the building blocks of proteins, amino acids, are way simpler.
They're chemically far simpler, and they're more abundant. The Miller-Urey experiment showed they form spontaneously, and we find them on meteorites. They're everywhere.
The strength of that idea is that it solves the metabolism problem right away.
Instantly. Proteins are abundant, they link up into chains easily, and they are the enzymes that drive all the reactions. But then you run into the exact opposite problem.
No heredity.
Right. How do proteins reproduce? How do they copy themselves without the genetic code from DNA or RNA to tell them how to fold into the right shape? So the theory stalled.
Until this fascinating third ingredient came into the picture. Prions.
Prions, which is a molecule we usually only hear about in the context of, you know, terrifying, incurable diseases like mad cow disease.
That seems like a very unlikely candidate for the foundation of all life.
It does, because we were only looking at the destructive ones. But we now know that prion-like proteins are actually really common and functional in lots of simple organisms.
Clear on what?
Playing roles in memory, in gene expression, immunity. They're a type of what's called an intrinsically disordered protein. And what makes them the missing ingredient is their unique replication mechanism.
And that's all about self-templating, based purely on shape. Can you break that down for us?
Sure. So most proteins fold into one single stable shape. That's their job. But prion-like proteins are different. They're constantly folding and unfolding into thousands of unstable shapes.
Okay.
The critical step is when one of these unstable copies bumps into a stable copy of itself. When they bind together, the new copy is stabilized into that exact same conformation.
And that conformation is often a really durable fibril.
Incredibly durable, highly resistant, and that fibril can then fragment into smaller pieces or seeds. And each one of those seeds can then go on and template the process all over again.
So a protein, just based on its physical shape, is making more copies of that shape. It's reproducing without any genetic instructions at all.
Precisely. It's decentralized reproduction at its most primitive, and it's a very robust form of replication.
Which leads us to the big unified conclusion of the article. Life didn't need one single miracle.
No, it just needed two simpler, messy processes to bump into each other. You had the chemical complexity of RNA and the self-templating durability of these prion-like proteins.
So the idea is that you had these separate little RNA worlds and prion worlds emerging on their own.
Exactly. And the collaboration started when those worlds overlapped. The proteins could offer the stability and the metabolic speed that the fragile RNA molecules desperately needed.
And this collaboration is what led to a primitive ribosome.
That's the hypothesis, yes. The formation of a primitive ribosome.
Which is the massive cellular factory in all life today that builds proteins. And it's made of both RNA and proteins. So the ribosome itself is the proof.
It's the ultimate smoking gun. Even today, the catalytic part of the ribosome, the bit that actually joins the amino acids together, is a ribozyme. It's an RNA enzyme.
Wow.
And that structure is virtually identical across all domains of life, mm-hmm. which suggests that this initial, highly unlikely collaboration was the birth of the primitive ribosome, and that's what kickstarted efficient evolution.
That is a profound thought. That the most efficient machine in all of biology is basically a monument to an ancient chemical compromise.
It is.
Okay, moving from the smallest spark of life to the absolute grandest structure of reality, black holes. We've got a feature here on the 50-year-old puzzle of black hole entropy, the disorder inside them.
Mm.
So why is calculating the entropy inside a black hole, by definition, an impossible task?
Well, classically, entropy, coming from Ludwig Boltzmann, is a measure of what is. You have to count every single microscopic configuration, the microstates of all the particles in the system.
But you can't see inside a black hole.
Exactly. The interior is permanently hidden by the event horizon, so we can't see what's inside to count the microstates. The information is fundamentally inaccessible to us.
So how did the Bekenstein-Hawking breakthrough get around this? They argue that black holes have to have entropy.
They came at it from the laws of the universe. Jacob Bekenstein realized that if you throw something with entropy, like, say, a cup of coffee into a black hole,
right,
you would be making a total entropy of the universe go down, which violates the second law of thermodynamics. The law says total disorder must always increase.
So the black hole itself has to gain that entropy to balance the books.
It has to. And Stephen Hawking confirmed this later, not by counting particles, but by showing that black holes emit quantum radiation Hawking radiation.
Which means they have a temperature.
And anything with a temperature must have entropy. So this Bekenstein-Hawking entropy is a measure based entirely on the physical surface area of the event horizon. It's a property of space-time geometry itself.
So the challenge then became trying to match this geometric property with quantum mechanics. Why did the standard quantum calculations keep failing and giving these meaningless infinities?
This is where we get into the second more modern idea of entropy, von Neumann's quantum entropy. This is a measure of uncertainty. It's not about what physically is there. It's about what we know about a system.
Okay.
When quantum theorists tried to apply their mathematical tools, these things called operator algebras, they made a critical mistake. They treated space-time as a fixed, rigid stage, ignoring gravity.
And of course, near a black hole, gravity is everything. Space-time is violently curved and dynamic.
Precisely. That static assumption just broke the calculations. It generated these infinite, totally unusable results.
So the mathematical breakthrough came in 2023 from a team led by Ed Witten.
The renowned physicist, yes. They finally figured out how to weave the effects of gravity into the calculations. By allowing space-time to be dynamic and interact with the quantum fields, this sort of feedback loop stabilized the math and tamed the infinities.
And this is the profound part. What did this newly stabilized quantum calculation of von Neumann entropy, what we know, end up equaling?
It exactly equals the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, the physical geometry.
Wow.
Boltzmann's what is mathematically the same as von Neumann's what we know, which means the entropy we can measure on the outside, the surface area, is a perfect holographic representation of all the quantum information on the inside.
You don't need to cross the event horizon to solve the puzzle. That is genuinely mind-bending.
It is.
But if the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy is a physical property of space-time, and it's now proven to be the same as our knowledge of the system, what does that suggest about the fundamental nature of gravity itself? Is it still this fixed universal force?
This is where it gets really startling. The implication, and this is highly speculative, is that gravity might not be a fixed universal constant.
What do you mean?
The math strongly suggests that gravity could be observer dependent. Think about the cosmological horizon, the edge of our observable universe. Mathematically, it behaves a lot like a black hole event horizon.
Okay.
So what an observer can see and measure from that horizon defines the information that's accessible to them. That information defines the quantum entropy they measure, which in turn dictates the space-time geometry and therefore the emergent force of gravity they experience.
So you're saying if I'm observing the universe from here, my access to information defines the gravity I experience, and that could be different for someone at the far reaches of the cosmos.
That's the idea. It completely challenges the notion of a single immutable force field governing everything equally. It shifts gravity from being a universal thing to being an emergent property that depends entirely on information flow.
That's a huge shift. Okay, from the complexity of gravity in the large, let's move to another fundamental law, or maybe a lack of one. The article asks if we need a fourth law of thermodynamics, specifically for living things.
Right. Classical thermodynamics works perfectly for non-living systems, for things that are moving towards maximum disorder, towards equilibrium.
But life is the opposite.
Life is fundamentally the opposite. I mean, cells actively burn huge amounts of energy just to maintain a state that is far from equilibrium. And critically, living systems have a set point.
A thermostat.
A thermostat, exactly. When you get too hot, you sweat. Too cold, you shiver. This active, goal-directed maintenance isn't captured by the classical laws.
So researchers were looking for a new metric to define how far a living system is from this equilibrium. What did they try?
They were working with HeLa cells. And first they tried using a traditional metric called effective temperature. But they found it was pretty imprecise when they were measuring fluctuations in the cell membranes.
So they proposed something else.
A team at Dresden University proposed something called time reversal asymmetry.
Time reversal asymmetry. That sounds very abstract.
It sounds more complicated than it is. If you film a non-living process, like ice melting in a drink, and you play that film backwards, it still looks physically plausible, right?
Yeah, you can imagine it happening.
But a living process looks fundamentally nonsensical in reverse. If you film a plant growing or a cell dividing and run that backward, it's just clearly wrong. Time reversal asymmetry measures the degree to which that process differs running backward versus forward.
So you're basically measuring the purposeful direction of life.
Mm-hmm.
The higher the asymmetry, the further it is from just being a random non-living system.
Exactly. The directionality of processes like cell division or just survival is what defines life's persistence. And by measuring this, they hope they can derive a new law that applies to any complex system that actively maintains a stable state.
Let's pivot back to the cosmos now and some of the mysteries that still plague us, specifically dark matter. We're seeing the first hints of dark matter stars.
Dark matter stars are a really radical idea that could solve two cosmological headaches at the same time.
Okay.
The hypothesis is that in the very early universe, you had these dense clouds of hydrogen gas that collapsed, not because of nuclear fusion, but because they trapped huge amounts of WIMP's weakly interacting massive particles.
The leading dark matter candidate.
Exactly. And instead of fusion starting at the core, the WIMPs would just smash into each other and annihilate, releasing a massive amount of energy.
So they would be powered by dark matter, not hydrogen.
That's the idea. This dark matter annihilation would provide the internal pressure to stop the star from collapsing, allowing it to shine.
And what would make these stars so important for the early universe?
Their size and their eventual fate. Unlike normal stars, which eventually blow off their outer layers or go supernova, these dark stars could theoretically just keep pulling in matter indefinitely.
Becoming enormous.
Incredibly massive. We're talking 1,000 to maybe 10 million times the mass of our sun. Eventually, gravity would win and they would collapse directly into a supermassive black hole.
Which would solve the mystery of the earliest supermassive black holes we see. The ones that are way too big to have formed so quickly through normal means.
Precisely. They're perfect candidates for the seeds that grew into those first supermassive black holes. And what's more, the James Webb Space Telescope has seen some strange things out there.
The little red dots and blue monsters.
Right. Objects that are too bright and too massive to be easily explained by normal galaxies forming so early. But they align perfectly with where we might expect to see these extremely massive dark stars.
I do have to inject a bit of skepticism here. I mean, these are extraordinary claims based on very distant, noisy data.
That is the essential critical question, and they do require extraordinary evidence. The proof has to be in their light signature.
How so?
Because dark stars are powered differently by annihilation, not fusion, they should absorb a particular wavelength of light that normal stars are just too hot to absorb.
And we're seeing hints of that.
The early JWST data hints at this unique absorption signature, but the background noise is still too high for a definitive confirmation. So until we have that unambiguous spectral data, it remains a compelling but unproven theory.
Speaking of WIMPs, there's another article here detailing an effort to finally detect the substance itself. What kind of radiation should WIMPs produce if they annihilate?
If WIMPs are the primary dark matter particle, when they self-annihilate, they should produce a specific flash of high-energy radiation, specifically gamma rays.
And a team in Tokyo analyzed years of data from the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope.
15 years of data. Tomonori Totani and his team focused on the Milky Way's outer halo, which is a region that should be rich in dark matter.
And after they painstakingly subtracted all the known sources of gamma rays, what did they find?
They found a leftover glow. An unexpected excess with an energy of about 20 gigaelectron volts. And that energy signature fits perfectly with the predictions for WIMP annihilation.
That sounds promising.
It's very exciting. Totani himself was skeptical at first, but after checking and rechecking, he called it the most promising candidate radiation from dark matter known to date.
The caveats have to be huge, though. It must be incredibly difficult to model every single other gamma ray source in a galaxy as complex as ours.
That's the challenge. And critics are quick to point out that while this signal is promising, we haven't seen a similar clear signal from other places we'd expect to see one. Like dwarf galaxies, which are almost entirely dark matter. If WIMPs are annihilating in our halo, they should definitely be annihilating in those small, dense galaxies too, and we're not seeing that.
So it's an anomaly, not a detection.
Not yet.
No.
Until we can confirm this signal across multiple independent sources, it remains a fascinating anomaly.
Let's move from the grand scale of the cosmos, back down to Earth, to physics you can actually hold in your hand. There's apparently a universal law that explains exactly how things shatter.
This is one of those pieces of physics that's both really elegant and highly practical. For decades, engineers have noticed that no matter what you break, glass, pottery, rock, the distribution of the fragment sizes always follows the same repeatable curve.
And Emmanuel Villermo finally derived the equation for it.
He did. And his genius wasn't trying to model every single individual crack, but in treating the whole event as a function of messiness or high entropy.
He just assumed it would be random and messy.
Exactly. He assumed maximum messiness and randomness, and he combined that with a known law that describes how the density of the fragments changes during the shattering. And out came this surprisingly simple universal equation.
And it works for everything from dry spaghetti to rock falls.
Everything. Windshields, plates, you name it.
So what are the real-world implications of understanding this?
It's pretty significant for energy efficiency and for safety. Industrial mining, for instance, uses enormous amounts of energy just to shatter ore. A better physics-based understanding of this law helps them optimize the crushing process.
Potentially saving huge amounts of power.
Huge amounts. And on the safety side, it improves our ability to model and prepare for rock falls in mountainous regions, which, with climate change, are becoming more frequent.
Let's shift our focus now entirely to human health and the body, starting with something surprising. Changes in the oral microbiome during pregnancy.
This is a deep dive into that old saying that you gain a child, lose a tooth. Dental issues are common during pregnancy, and they're usually blamed on hormonal changes.
Researchers wanted to see if the ecosystem of bacteria in the mouth was playing a role.
Exactly. And their study of 346 women found that pregnancy basically accelerates the aging of the mouth.
What does that mean?
Well, they found that the oral microbiome undergoes a sort of fast-forward evolution. Diversity, which is a key marker of a healthy microbiome, just dropped progressively across all three trimesters.
And that's a change that would normally take years.
A change that normally takes many, many years is compressed into 9 months, which leaves the environment much more vulnerable to inflammation-linked bacteria.
Were there specific bacterial changes they identified?
Yes, very specific ones. They saw a progressive reduction in a good bacterium called Akkermansia muciniphila, and at the same time, an increase in groups linked to inflammation, like gamma proteobacteria and Synergistota.
And this was linked to lifestyle factors during pregnancy.
It was. Things like diet, stress, nausea, all common during pregnancy, were directly linked to these microbial population shifts.
Beyond the immediate risk of, say, gum disease for the parent, what are the potential long-term implications for the child?
This is the really critical connection. The mother's inflammatory status, which is partly driven by this oral imbalance, can directly influence the child's developing immune system in the womb.
Priming their immune response.
It can prime their immune response, potentially affecting their susceptibility to allergies, asthma, or even long-term chronic inflammatory conditions later in life. It's a huge connection.
Speaking of triggering internal responses, let's talk about cold water swimming and ice baths. It's a massive trend. What is the neuroscience telling us about the benefits?
The trend is immense, yeah. We're seeing millions of regular outdoor swimmers. And the science really does confirm the hype. Regular cold exposure reduces fatigue, helps manage depression, and improves mood, memory, and cardiovascular health.
So what is the immediate chemical cocktail that gives you that mood high, the one that's similar to intense exercise?
It's an acute stress response. The sudden shock of cold water triggers an evolutionary survival mechanism, the cold shock response.
Right.
This instantly spikes your levels of adrenaline, dopamine, and cortisol. You get this burst of energy, pain reduction, and hyper alertness. You get all the benefits of the stress response without the actual threat.
And the benefits might go beyond that immediate high.
Yeah.
There's evidence of potential long-term neuroprotection.
Yeah. This is where it gets truly interesting. The exposure stimulates the release of a specific protein, RNA-binding motif protein 3, or RBM3.
And what does that do?
This protein has been shown to support synapse repair, the critical connections between your neurons. In mice that were predisposed to Alzheimer's, increased RBM3 levels actually protected them from neurological damage.
So the cold shock might be tapping into a deep neuroprotective pathway.
That's the idea. And the brain scans seem to back this up. They show actual shifts in the regions that control our emotions.
How so?
Researchers scanned people before and after cold immersion and found beneficial changes in the connectivity between the medial prefrontal cortex and the parietal lobe.
And those are the areas for emotional control and decision making.
Exactly. The very regions that are often compromised in anxiety and depression. So the physical changes in connectivity provide a clear neurological basis for this working as a therapeutic tool.
Okay, let's move from choosing to subject yourself to cold to the ethical challenge of choosing to subject yourself to illness. Human challenge trials.
Right, where healthy volunteers are intentionally infected with pathogens like COVID or dysentery to speed up research.
The article suggests that the pandemic really shifted the ethical calculation on this.
Absolutely. Challenge trials have always been controversial, but the sheer urgency of the pandemic made the accelerated time frame they offer irresistible and, well, broadly ethically acceptable as long as the risks are minimized.
What are the main practical advantages they have over a conventional field trial?
The speed is unmatched. You're talking about results in weeks versus years. They also need way fewer participants. But the real advantage is the precision.
How so?
Because the participants are in a controlled, biosecure environment from the moment they're infected, researchers can track the disease from the very onset. They can give precise doses and observe the initial immune response, things like mucosal immunity, which is almost impossible to track in the wild.
And this has led to building massive, purpose-built quarantine facilities, like Vaccinopolis in Antwerp.
Vaccinopolis, yeah, a $20 million investment designed to host these trials, even with biosafety level 3 pathogens like certain coronaviruses or TD. It has negative pressure rooms, sophisticated filtration. It's the bedrock for what they're calling Vaccinology 2.0.
And Vaccinology 2.0 is focused heavily on mucosal vaccines.
Correct. We're shifting away from conventional injected vaccines, which are great at stopping you from getting really sick, but often don't stop you from transmitting the virus.
No, these are nasal sprays or tablets?
Nasal sprays or oral tablets, yeah. They're designed to trigger immunity right at the front line in the nose and throat. And if you can stop the virus from replicating there, you block transmission. You get to herd immunity much faster.
And challenge trials are really the only way to measure that frontline response accurately.
They are.
The ethics, though, have to be rigorously debated. They guarantee a rescue treatment to stop severe symptoms. But how do they handle the risk of long-term effects, like long COVID?
That is the ongoing friction. The motivation for volunteers, like Jake Eberts in the article who volunteered for dysentery and Zika trials, is a powerful mix of altruism and financial compensation.
Which can be thousands of dollars.
Thousands of dollars for a period of quarantine. But ethicists stress that the consent process has to be rock solid, especially about unknown long-term risks.
Eberts' own account was pretty brutal.
He said he was one of the sickest in the cohort after drinking a Shigella-laced shake. It shows the experience is tough. The consensus is that while the public health value is immense, the protocols have to be stripped, transparent, and non-exploitative.
That really highlights the courage of those individuals.
It does.
Let's move to a large-scale analysis of human development, looking at the dramatic turning points in the brain's wiring throughout our lives. What did this huge MRI study find?
The study of three other 800 people found that the brain doesn't just improve or decline in a straight line. It goes through five distinct phases of wiring changes.
Separated by four predictable turning points.
Right, happening at roughly ages 9, 32, 66, and 83.
So walk us through that first major phase from birth up to age 9.
In phase one, the brain is all about establishing broad, diffuse connections, which actually means that the efficiency, the speed of information travel decreases. The brain is prioritizing exploration, casting a wide net.
With the idea that unused connections will get pruned later.
Exactly. Then around age 9, driven by puberty, phase two begins and lasts until about 32. This phase is all about a dramatic increase in efficiency. The brain streamlines connections to support complex skills like planning and memory.
This is peak efficiency.
This is the peak of streamlined network efficiency. Then you have the longest phase, phase three, from 32 to 66, which is a long, gradual period where that efficiency starts to wane again.
And then in later life.
From age 83 onward, the brain starts to rely heavily on centralized, highly connected hubs to maintain its overall function, basically compensating for weaker connections elsewhere.
And establishing this normal trajectory is crucial for medicine, right?
It provides the essential baseline. When researchers are looking at conditions like schizophrenia or Alzheimer's, they can now pinpoint exactly where and when the wiring deviates from this typical path.
Which allows for much more targeted diagnosis and treatment.
Hopefully, yes. Treatment aimed at correcting the disruption at the precise moment it occurs.
Before we move on from health, a quick but important note on severe asthma treatment.
Yes, this is a big deal for patients who rely on daily oral steroids, which have severe side effects like diabetes and bone loss.
There's a new monthly injection.
A monthly antibody injection called tezepelumab. In the trial, nearly half the participants were able to get off their daily steroid pills completely. And another 40% significantly reduced their dosage. It's a much safer, highly effective alternative.
That's fantastic news. Okay, speaking of complex life coexisting across time, that shift in brain phases leads us nicely into the complexity of ancient history and ecology. Let's go back 3.4 million years.
We're talking about the discovery of the Bertholdt foot in Ethiopia. It was a 3.4 million year old hominin foot bone that was immediately mysterious because it had this gorilla-like opposable big toe.
Perfect for climbing trees.
Perfect for tree climbing. And it clearly didn't belong to Lucy's species, Australopithecus afarensis, which we know was walking on 2 feet on the ground nearby.
So who did this foot belong to?
Subsequent findings, including a jawbone, confirmed it belonged to Australopithecus diarmida. And the huge revelation is the timing. These two hominin species were contemporaries. They lived in the same area at the same time.
Which really complicates that simple linear evolutionary tree we all learned.
It does. And the next question is, did they compete for resources?
You'd assume so. Two similar species in the same niche.
That's the most surprising finding. Carbon isotope analysis of their teeth showed they weren't. A. diarmida was primarily eating food from trees and shrubs, still very much an arboreal life.
While Lucy's species was eating grass.
A. afarensis had a diet much richer in grasses and ground-level plants. They weren't fighting over the same menu. As the researcher said, they must have seen each other. It implies a much more complex and maybe cooperative early evolutionary landscape.
That theme of decentralized complexity again. Okay, let's apply that idea of simple necessity leading to complex structure to this next thesis, that taxable crops led to the emergence of the first states.
This is a really powerful theory. It uses statistical methods from mapping biological evolution to map cultural evolution. And the core argument isn't just that agriculture created a food surplus.
But that it created a taxable surplus.
A surplus that could be easily controlled and monitored by a rising elite.
So specific crops were a prerequisite for government.
Absolutely. The data showed that centralized state formation was highly unlikely without widespread production of cereal grains, wheat, barley, rice, maize.
And root crops were useless for this.
They were found to be hopeless for taxation. Because grains grow in fixed fields, they ripen predictably. And crucially, they can be easily measured and stored for long periods. They are perfectly suited for a government to assess and collect.
And the theory frames the first states as something like a sophisticated protection racket.
That's the functional interpretation, yeah. The elite emerged to consolidate power over this storable surplus, offering protection for the fields in exchange for a mandatory tax.
And this connects to the origin of writing.
A very compelling connection. They found that writing was highly unlikely to be adopted in societies that didn't have a tax system. The evidence overwhelmingly suggests writing was invented and adopted to record those taxes.
Yes, to manage the grain.
Yeah.
A very functional, almost mundane origin for something as profound as civilization and literacy.
Exactly.
Let's turn now to the end of a civilization. The Indus Valley Civilization. New research shows its collapse was driven by prolonged climate change, not one single event.
Right. The Indus Valley, or Harappan civilization, was known for these massive, sophisticated cities. And it was thought to have declined suddenly around 4,200 years ago because of a single global mega drought.
But the new data paints a much more drawn-out picture.
It does. Using climate models and lake sediments, researchers found that the region was hit by not one, but four distinct and severe droughts between 4,400 and 3,400 years ago.
And each one lasted for decades.
At least 85 years each. And temperatures also rose by about half a degree Celsius. These prolonged, intense conditions just overwhelmed their infrastructure.
So how did the Harappan people respond?
It wasn't a sudden exodus. They depended on the Indus River's annual flood, so they began to slowly abandon the colossal cities and migrate eastward, clustering closer to the perennial water sources near the Himalayan foothills and the Ganga River plain.
So the civilization just fragmented into smaller communities.
It fragmented. A slow retreat from urban centers back towards smaller, more agriculturally resilient settlements, all driven by climate necessity.
Moving from human history to our modern relationship with animals, let's start with the surprising genetic history of the domestic cat. We think they've been with us forever, but the spread was actually quite late.
Much later than you'd think. Genetic evidence confirms they came from the African wildcat, but a study of ancient cat genomes revealed that the true domestic cat only began to spread into Europe around the 2nd century AD.
Mostly through Mediterranean civilizations.
Exactly. And the delay is even more pronounced in the East. Domestic cats didn't even arrive in China until about 1,300 years ago, traveling along the Silk Road with traders.
And this leads us to the commentary on why we should stop treating our pets like fur babies, a necessary but tough critique.
It is. The author, Eddie Clutton, argues that this increasing trend of anthropomorphizing pets, treating them like surrogate children, is actually really detrimental to their welfare.
What are the specific hazards he mentions?
Physically, excessive pampering, like using dog strollers for healthy animals, leads to muscle wastage, joint damage, and a massive pet obesity epidemic.
And psychologically?
Restricting their natural behaviors, their need to explore, mark territory, interact with other animals, causes significant fear and anxiety. We're projecting our emotional needs onto them at the expense of their biological needs.
And he's particularly critical of the veterinary profession.
He is. He argues some are capitalizing on this misguided love by pushing gold standard overtreatment unnecessary, invasive procedures like radiotherapy for geriatric animals. The ethical line, he stresses, has to be absolute. The animal's welfare must always prioritize its biology over the owner's emotional desire for endless life extension.
A difficult but crucial check on our modern habits.
For sure.
On a lighter note for animal behavior, we have the first recorded instances of tool use in giant pandas. The myth of the lazy panda is being challenged.
It is. Pandas have long been seen as these simple, food-obsessed creatures. But researchers recorded over 380 instances of captive giant pandas selecting and using twigs or bamboo to scratch hard-to-reach areas,
suggesting short-term planning.
And more complex cognition than we've given them credit for. The key, of course, is their false thumb, that specialized wrist bone that lets them grasp things. They're leveraging that ability to solve a problem.
It's a small observation, but it fundamentally changes the perception of their intelligence.
It does.
We also have a very strange biological adaptation found in threatened frogs infected with a deadly fungus. It makes them jump further.
This is a truly remarkable observation about the desperation of nature. Varroa's alpine tree frogs infected with the devastating chytrid fungus were found to jump nearly 24% further than uninfected frogs.
Why would a pathogen boost athletic performance?
It's hypothesized to be a last hop effort, a desperate biological adaptation. Since the fungus is fatal, this burst in jumping ability may be an adaptation to quickly find a mate for one final reproductive effort before death.
Ironically, this helps the fungus too.
Exactly. By increasing the host's movement and range, the pathogen's transmission rate also increases. It helps it spread more effectively.
Let's move to global systems and environmental dynamics. And we're starting with what might be the most globally concerning item in this entire deep dive. Africa's forests have become a net carbon source.
This is a fundamental reversal, a major blow to climate goals. African forests used to be one of the world's most critical carbon sinks, absorbing about 20% of all CO2 taken up by plants globally.
But new data shows they lost 106 million tons of biomass annually between 2011 and 2017.
And that loss translates directly to a massive contribution to atmospheric CO2. We're talking about roughly 200 million tons of CO2 emissions annually.
Driven by deforestation in the Congo.
Primarily relentless deforestation in the Congo rainforest, fueled by small-scale mining and, crucially, illegal logging of hardwoods.
The implication for global climate policy is immediate. If a critical global sink flips into a source, the timeline for cutting fossil fuel emissions just got much shorter.
It got significantly harder, exactly. We've lost a major natural buffer, which means global fossil fuel emissions have to be cut even faster to compensate. It underscores the desperate need to fund initiatives like the Tropical Forests Forever Facility. This isn't just an ecological story, it's a geopolitical emergency.
Let's look at a potential solution for our insatiable demand for metals. A proposed greener way to do deep sea mining.
Deep sea mining is highly controversial. It involves scraping these valuable metal nodules from the pristine ocean floor. And conventional methods have a massive carbon footprint.
So the Max Planck Institute has a proposal that aims for zero emissions by using a hydrogen plasma method. How does that work?
Instead of a traditional smelter, they put the ground-up nodules into an electric arc furnace filled with hydrogen gas. High-energy electrons create a hydrogen plasma, which superheats the material and strips the oxygen away from metal oxides, leaving pure metal behind.
And the zero emissions claim hinges entirely on the energy source.
It does. It only works if the electricity is from renewables and the hydrogen is green hydrogen, made using renewable energy. If you do that, the only byproducts are water and usable manganese compounds.
But I have to challenge the premise here. If the land-based mining industry, which is already regulated, just adopted the same green hydrogen and the renewable electricity, wouldn't that negate the carbon advantage of going to the deep sea?
That is the critical counterpoint raised in the article. The plasma process is cleaner than fossil fuel-based deep sea mining, for sure. But it offers no fundamental carbon advantage over land mining if land mining just modernizes with renewables.
And the core environmental risk of disturbing the deep sea floor remains.
It remains. The argument is that we should invest in modernizing existing regulated land operations before we potentially ruin a new, poorly understood ecosystem.
That makes perfect sense. Okay, let's pivot to the world of tech and the AI chip shakeup, the market battle between NVIDIA's GPUs and Google's specialized TPUs.
Right. NVIDIA has been dominant, but their chips, their GPUs, weren't originally designed for AI. They were built for computer graphics and gaming.
Their success in AI was architectural luck.
It was. They're excellent at parallel calculation, doing thousands of simple operations at once, which turned out to be perfect for the massive matrix multiplication needed to train AI models.
But because they're general purpose, they're not as efficient as a specialized competitor like Google's tensor processing units.
Exactly. Google pioneered TPUs in the mid-2010s. They are designed solely for matrix multiplication. They strip away everything else. This specialization leads to far higher efficiency and huge cost savings. We're talking hundreds of millions of dollars for companies running colossal models.
And NVIDIA held on for so long because their software was so much easier to use. Has that bottleneck for TPUs been solved?
It has. That was the main hurdle. The software was bespoke and complicated. But the newest generation of TPUs, Ironwood, has matured. The software is now generalized and robust, so usability is no longer the limiting factor.
And the market shift is happening now, challenging NVIDIA's monopoly. Who's buying TPUs?
The big hyperscalers and leading AI companies. For a long time, Google kept TPUs mostly for itself. Now, major players like Meta, Anthropic, and others are making sizable purchases of Google's cloud TPU power. This diversification introduces real competition, which should help drive down the cost of AI research for everyone.
The era of NVIDIA's unchallenged dominance might finally be ending.
It seems so.
We've covered a lot of ground. Let's run through our final fascinating quick hits, starting with existential isolation.
This is a really powerful concept. It's the feeling of being profoundly alienated or misunderstood, even when you're surrounded by people, like being at a crowded party but feeling completely separate.
The sense that no one really gets you.
And it's a major risk factor for depression. The irony, of course, is that many people around you are probably feeling the exact same thing.
So what's the solution?
Cultivating common humanity, recognizing this pain isn't unique to you. And research on the beautiful mess effect shows that when you do share a personal problem, people tend to respond not with judgment, but with courage and connection.
Next up, the neuroscience of generating tunes in your head. When you hum a melody silently, what parts of the brain are working?
Surprisingly, it's not your primary auditory cortex, the area that processes actual external sound. Instead, imagining a melody activates the secondary auditory cortex, which is responsible for analyzing and sequencing sounds.
And it engages working memory, too.
Strongly. It confirms that mentally generating music is a true cognitive skill, leveraging memory and organization, which is why composers can practice and develop it.
We have to touch on the Red Planet's long-standing mystery, the excess xenon on Mars. Does it still lend any credence to the idea of an ancient Martian nuclear event?
It's a polarizing scientific mystery. It's all about isotope ratios. Xenon-129 is a decay product of iodine-129. On Earth, we find roughly equal amounts of decay products from that and from plutonium-244.
But on Mars, there's way more xenon-129.
2.5 times more than expected. The extreme minority view argues natural processes can't account for that, and that thermonuclear explosions preferentially produce iodine-129, pointing to some ancient catastrophe.
In the orthodox view,
is that it's due to natural geological outgassing. But that 2.5-fold discrepancy is still a very persistent and difficult anomaly to explain away.
Finally, we end on the most wonderfully human failure. The cryptic security failure at the International Association for Cryptologic Research.
The people who designed the world's most sophisticated security systems were thwarted by what?
Simple human fallibility. It's the perfect end to any tech story. The IACR used a super sophisticated encrypted online voting platform. To decrypt the final tally, 3 trustees had to combine their portions of the cryptographic key.
You needed all 3 pieces.
All 3. And what happened?
One of the 3 trustees, through an honest but unfortunate human mistake, simply and irretrievably lost their 1/3 of the private key. Because of the all-or-nothing security design, the results were unrecoverable. The election had to be voided and restarted. It just shows that no matter how complex your digital security is, leaving the key under the doormat is always the biggest point of failure.
That is just phenomenal irony. They're now implementing a 2 out of 3 threshold, which seems sensible.
A necessary correction for the human element.
We've covered immense territory today, from solving the universe's biggest gravitational mysteries by suggesting gravity is observer-dependent,
to the slow, fragmented retreat of the Indus Valley civilization due to climate change.
What consistently stands out across all of this is the triumph of complexity emerging from decentralized or accidental processes.
I agree. Life didn't need one perfect molecule. It needed 2 messy ones, prions and RNA, to find a way to collaborate. global power structures didn't emerge from some genius leader. They came from the simple necessity of taxing storable grain.
Which brings us to our final provocative thought for you to consider. We often tell ourselves a history driven by powerful, centralized forces, great leaders, monolithic governments, singular scientific genius.
But what if, as we're now seeing in research on the Rapa Nui Moai statues, those monuments weren't built by one megalomaniacal chief, but by 30 separate competing communities, all vying for status?
What if the earliest, most foundational social structures, like the state, were driven entirely by the economic reality of assessing fixed crops?
It raises the question. If competition, decentralized effort, or even simple necessity drive our monumental achievements more than top-down command, how should we adjust our modern narratives of power and coordination?
And how does that lens change the way you view the decentralized emergence of competitors to NVIDIA in the AI chip market today?
It certainly makes you wonder what decentralized forces are shaping our future right now, often completely beneath the radar of the centralized figures we tend to focus on.
A truly profound thought to end on. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into The New Scientist. We hope you feel thoroughly well-informed.
Always a pleasure.
We'll see you next time.